I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. It was a tumultuous week for the White House last week, with business leaders abandoning the president's business councils because of his unwillingness to unambiguously repudiate the neo-Nazis and white supremacists whose rally in Charlottesville turned ugly and violent. He then pulled the plug on the councils. Trump was also criticized by military and foreign leaders and by members of his own party, including Senator Corker of Tennessee.
I will say we're at a point where there needs to be radical changes take place at the White House itself. It has to happen. I think our president needs to take stock of the role that he plays in our nation and move beyond himself, move way beyond himself, and move to a place where daily he's waking up thinking about what is best for our nation.
Then on Friday, Steve Bannon, the populist firebrand who was a key architect of Trump's presidential campaign and chief White House strategist, was out. We asked Ron Elving to join us. He's senior editor and national correspondent for NPR's Washington Desk, and he joins us from the studios of NPR. Ron Elving, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ron, was Steve Bannon pushed? Did he jump? Does it matter?
It's a combination of all of the above. And it does matter because it is going to influence where the Trump presidency goes, and it's going to influence how the conservative community reacts to that new direction. But let's start with a little earlier this summer when John Kelly became the chief of staff, replacing Reince Priebus, who was pushed out. John Kelly had been the head of the Department of Homeland Security. He is a retired Marine general. And when he took over as chief of staff, there were conversations between him and Steve Bannon, in which it was made clear that Bannon would have to report to Kelly and not directly to the president as he had been doing. So that really made Bannon's status quite different and made probably inevitable his eventual departure. Then that became urgent with the crisis after Charlottesville, and it became convenient after Bannon himself started calling reporters late at night and putting out this manifesto about his status at the White House and what would happen in the future.
Well, and I'm grabbing for pieces of paper here. Of course, the American Prospect interview, that seemed to be Steve Bannon saying, you know, I'm the captain here. I'm in charge of the White House. Then he also had a interview with the Weekly Standard in which Steve Bannon said the Trump presidency, what we fought for and won, is over. We still have a huge movement and we will make something of this Trump presidency. He's already now back at Breitbart. How do you interpret those words?
Steve Bannon has always been more interested in perhaps changing the direction of the country than he has been in any particular political office or any politician. He was not initially a Donald Trump fan. He was not initially a Donald Trump supporter during the primaries, but he did come to Trump and become Trump's chairman of his campaign in August of last year. In fact, it was just a year and one day before he was pushed out. And he has had this mission in his own mind that he is going to reestablish the United States that he imagines from the past and that he believes has been disadvantaged in the post-World War II era by trade, by immigration, by too much aid to other countries, doing too much for others, not demanding enough from others for the United States. Basically, summed up in the phrase, America first.
Well, and I'm looking at this American Prospect piece where he told Robert Kuttner, in Kim, Trump has met his match. The risk of two arrogant fools blundering into a nuclear exchange is more serious than at any time since October 1962. Now, that may be true, but he's calling the President of the United States an arrogant fool.
And comparing him to Kim Jong-un. That's upsetting, obviously, and clearly was not going to sit well with the president. That was probably, as some people have described it, the last straw. And there are to some degree two narratives here. One is that Bannon was on his way out earlier this summer. They were just looking for a time and a place for him to fall. And the other is that it all could have been worked out and Bannon could have remained perhaps indefinitely until he made that phone call to Robert Kuttner at the American Prospect and said all those terrible things. And that was not the only one. I mean, there were many things that were rather outrageous about that interview. And, of course, the next day, Bannon's friends were saying, oh, gee, Steve didn't really know he was talking to a reporter on the record.
Really? Really?
Where have we heard that before? It sounds a lot like Mr. Scaramucci, doesn't it?
Well, another quote here. I'm changing out people at East Asian Defense. I'm getting Hawks in. I'm getting Susan Thornton, acting head of East Asia, Asian and Pacific Affairs out at State. There's Treasury and Gary Cohn and Goldman Sachs. I mean, he names names. And it does sound like he's saying, you know, basically, I'm in charge of a lot of this stuff.
In his own mind, he seems to have been, and there were surely times when he had confirmation of that impression from the president himself. So he had his own notion of where this presidency was going. It's described as populist. That's kind of a vague term. It's a term that we all use in our own way.
Yeah.
And what he defined as the populist notion of where America should go was probably pretty well summed up when he said that the president had it right the first time he responded to Charlottesville, and that he was very happy with the way the president came back to that view on Tuesday at Trump Tower after having momentarily given a more conventional response in which he actually condemned neo-Nazis and the KKK.
Was, as some people have said, was Steve Bannon Trump's brain to go back to the Bush administration and Karl Rove and President Bush? Should we see him that way?
Karl Rove had a much, much longer relationship with George W. Bush and probably did a great deal more actual work for George W. Bush and probably had a lot more to do with actually getting George W. Bush elected than Steve Bannon could claim in just the short time that he was with Trump from August to November. But he did play a crucial role because he did stop the bleeding in the Trump campaign in August of 2016. He did turn things around to some degree by getting a little more control over the candidate. And at crucial times in the fall, particularly the last 2 weeks, when suddenly the onus was back on Hillary Clinton, he managed to keep Trump under wraps, keep him quiet, keep him on script, keep him away from Twitter to a large degree, and control his speeches so that the emphasis could stay on Hillary Clinton and Trump could use the last days of the campaign to recover from some of his mistakes and from the debates and maximize his advantage in those key places, in those key three states on election day that got him elected.
Do you think Trump without Bannon will be a different president?
Yes, there's no question that any time you take away a chief strategist, someone who has had walk-in privileges in the Oval Office, someone who has shaped so much of Trump's rhetoric and also confirmed certain elements of Trump's own personality so strongly, if you take that person away, it's going to make a difference. It certainly emphasizes the power of John Kelly, the new chief of staff that we mentioned, and also of Ivanka and her husband, Jared Kushner, and also of some people in the White House that are sometimes referred to as the New Yorkers or the Wall Streeters.
Or the Democrats, I've heard that he referred to some people that way, right?
And in fact, some of these people do have backgrounds with Democrats and have given money to Democratic candidates. And we should say it also empowers H.R. McMaster at the National Security Council. Mm-hmm. He's the National Security Advisor. He is more of a military interventionist. He himself is another retired general. And it empowers him and it empowers Secretary of Defense Mattis. So the three generals, if you will, Kelly, McMaster, and Mattis, all have a clearer line to the president and a freer hand in the absence of Steve Bannon.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens from Breitbart. I'm looking at actually the headline today. Source: McMaster fails to brief Trump before "that's too bad" error. This is about the collision in the Pacific between the ship Senator John McCain. I'm not sure what kind of ship it is, but it crashed into another ship, and it seems to be, you know, blaming McMaster for not telling Trump more about it before Trump made his "that's too bad" comment.
Yes, perhaps. Well, we don't really know the truth of how much briefing the president had and whose fault that might have been. Presumably, McMaster would have been in some sense involved, others as well. I believe that ship, the John McCain, is named for the senator's father, who was an admiral in World War II.
Of course, that makes sense.
And his name is John S. McCain, and that's the name of the ship. And I think it was a destroyer.
Thank you for that clarification. So how unusual is it, Ron Elving, 6 months into a presidency, to have the director of the FBI fired, the national security advisor fired, the Scaramucci White House communication director, he's out, the White House press secretary, that, of course, was Sean Spicer, he's out, Reince Priebus, White House chief of staff, and now, of course, chief strategist Steve Bannon. How unusual is that?
Well, it's totally unusual. No one has any kind of a precedent for this. Something like 8 major heads have rolled in 7 months. And these might not be the last ones either. And so there are other people in the administration, other people even in the cabinet, who are rumored to be on the edge of going out. Probably no one's going to jump now. They'll wait to see where things go in the next few days and weeks with Steve Bannon gone and John Kelly in charge. But it is terribly upsetting to many people who expect a certain amount of continuity, expect a certain amount of normality to have established itself in a White House after 7 months. But this is an unusual administration, obviously, and Donald Trump is a highly unusual president. And we must say the people who voted for Donald Trump wanted something different. They didn't want the same old in Washington. They didn't want things to go forward as they had. They didn't want business as usual, and they certainly have not had that.
Well, he certainly has his critics, but he also, he meaning the president, has his key supporters. Even if it's 35%, many of them are Republicans or certainly voted for him last November.
Yes. I don't think that Donald Trump has attracted a lot of new supporters since January. That there may be more than we know, but there isn't a lot of statistical evidence to show that he has gained a lot of supporters from people who voted for Hillary Clinton or perhaps did not vote at all or voted for a third-party candidate. It seems that what he has done is he has held 70-80% of the Republicans, and he has held a similar percentage of the people that voted for him. And now, of course, in the long run, if that doesn't improve, that's not enough. But as you say, there remains a very strong core of support that seems impervious to events, that has not seemed to fluctuate with good weeks and bad weeks for Donald Trump. It seems to be there for him in any event.
And we're almost having a break here. Why do you think that is?
Because I believe they see his presidency very personally. They see their own identity in it. They feel that when someone asks, would you vote for Donald Trump again, they're being asked whether or not they'd rather have Hillary Clinton as president, and they wouldn't. So they say, I support Donald Trump.
And that is Ron Elving. We asked him to join us today in Radio Times to talk about President Trump's week last week. I'm curious about what he would say to the question. So how did you spend your summer vacation? A busy couple of weeks. Ron Elving, senior editor and national correspondent for NPR's Washington Desk. We have more to talk about after this very short break, and we want you to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I know everyone is solar eclipse crazy today. We are talking about politics, and you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyy. Why Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Ron Elving at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. about last week's week of politics and some crisis and controversy and looking ahead to this week as well. Ron, we played the clip of Senator Corker, who was quite critical of the president last week. Was that unusual coming from that particular senator?
Yes. Bob Corker is a calm, very careful senator from Tennessee who is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has a lot of responsibility for articulating foreign policy for the Republican Party, and has tried very hard to deal with the differences, the contrast between his own approach to issues and that of Donald Trump. And because their personalities are so different, because Bob Corker tends to be a very soft-spoken politician, he has seemed reluctant to criticize the president's style. But last week, in the wake of the Charlottesville breakdown, if you will, and the president's wobbling on that issue and then finally coming down on the side he had initially done and angering so many people, Bob Corker just had had enough And the two words that he used, he seemed to have chosen them quite carefully, and they were stability right. and competence.
Yes.
And that's pretty basic stuff, and it really got a lot of people's attention, partly because it was coming from Bob Corker.
Was he saying, though, what other Republicans don't want to say in public?
Yes. I don't think there's any question. I think we can all report that many Republicans in private use terms much like that. They wonder if the president is okay. They wonder if the president sort of is comfortable in the job. They wonder if the president is somehow just not familiar enough with how government works to perform the functions of a president. He's had a variety of other people around him, some of whom had a lot of government experience, many of whom did not, or had experience in parts of the government such as the military that operate quite differently from Washington, D.C. And here's the problem with Washington, D.C. Everybody in Washington, D.C. that has power got elected or appointed by somebody who did and feels they have their own power base, their own power source. They don't necessarily all look to one leader, one commander for all their direction.
Do you anticipate then something different in the fall when members of Congress get back from their vacation? And of course, the inability for the Republicans to pass any changes or even to undo the Affordable Care Act.
This is actually an example, I think, about what Bob Corker is talking about. The president should know when he issues these edicts saying that Congress should come back and get right back to work on the Affordable Care Act, repealing it and replacing it. He should know that they can't do that at this point. There's no vehicle for it. There's no bill that can go forward at this point. They would really have to go back to the drawing board. And they can't do that in September because they have a big pile of other work to do. The homework they haven't done all year long, which is passing the appropriations bills, lifting the debt ceiling, which we've already exceeded and which will start making the government run out of cash approximately in October. And they still haven't even passed a budget resolution. So they have to get all those things done before the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th, which will be here before you know it. And if they don't get all that done, the government shuts down, at least partially, at least temporarily.
And isn't tax reform on the list and infrastructure? Last week was supposed to be all about infrastructure. Isn't that also on the to-do list?
Yes, they're both on the list, and they're both quite popular. I think both parties want to do tax reform. I think both parties definitely want to do infrastructure. The president wants to do those things. But they can't do that until they finish their homework. They have to finish the spending bills. They have to finish the debt ceiling increase, which is a very contentious issue. Many Republicans don't want to vote for a higher debt limit. But it is their government now, and they don't really have an alternative. They have to keep borrowing money. The federal government runs on a deficit every year, and we've got all the debt from the previous 200 years. So we do have to keep borrowing money and rolling over those treasury bonds, et cetera, et cetera. And it's unpleasant. It's a task that nobody wants to vote for, but it has to get done. And so do the spending bills. There are 12 of them. The government needs to do the basics in order to run and serve the people who elected them.
Well, no one likes to do their homework, no matter how old they are. Is there bipartisanship in Congress, Ron?
It does exist. It's a little bit below the radar because at this phase in our national politics, it does not really work well for you politically to be seen as too cooperative with the other party. It used to. It used to be a plus to be able to say that you had friends across the aisle. And it is still in many places in November elections. The problem is that many members of Congress now, perhaps the majority of members of Congress in the House in particular, find their greatest competition for re-election not in November, but in their primary election. They're more worried about getting a primary within their party, which means they have to show that they're good Democrats, good Republicans, highly partisan, not working with the other side, so as to discourage anyone within their party from challenging them for their renomination. That may sound a little technical, but that is really what's going on, and it really does prevent the kind of bipartisanship that got things done in the past.
I'm looking at something that Tom Ridge said, former governor of Pennsylvania. He also was a member of Congress and first director of Homeland Security, and again, kind of a mild-mannered man. But he said in an interview, at what point does a principled party stand up for its principles? And he goes on from there, you can't be afraid of losing an election because you stood up for what was right. I'm not sure what kind of clout he has within his party, but I thought it was interesting to hear that from Tom Ridge.
Yes, Tom Ridge was a governor of Pennsylvania. He was the first director of the Homeland Security Department, and he was a congressman, as you say. He's a attractive big guy who one would think might have had something of a future in presidential politics at one time in the Republican Party, but he had a couple of strikes against him. One was that he was seen as a little too bipartisan. Another was that he was pro-choice as opposed to pro-life, and that's a very important issue in both parties. And finally, he was from the Northeast, which is, generally speaking, not the sweet spot for Republican candidates right now. Of course, Donald Trump is from New York and Manhattan,
exactly.
So he violates all such strictures and all the things that we thought we knew about politics, but we've been over that ground before.
And, of course, Pennsylvania went for Donald Trump just to show how much of it's part of the Northeast. He goes on to talk about a party of principle requires leadership, but at this time we're kind of rudderless, talking about the Republican Party. Is the Democratic Party also rudderless, do you think, Ron?
There is not a clear leader of the Democratic Party, and that's generally true of the party that's not in the White House, unless there's someone who's just obviously their next nominee, and that certainly is not the case for these Democrats. They're not likely to be going back to Hillary Clinton. They're not likely to be going back to Joe Biden because of his age, although he is popular in the party. So there's a whole new generation needed, but that generation has not really emerged yet. We're talking about people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are not particularly youthful. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is new on the scene, but by the time she were president, she'd be well into her 70s, and Bernie Sanders is already well into his 70s. So the issue is for the Democrats to come up with a new generation of leadership. The Republicans have already shown a lot more presidential ambition because they had such a huge field in 2016.
Right. That is Ron Elving, senior editor and national correspondent for NPR's Washington Desk, joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. We've been talking about the President's Week last week, looking ahead, of course, to what's on the agenda come the fall. And again, you can join our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Ron, you had an interesting piece. Racial issues have been a test for U.S. presidents with conflicted feelings, walking through not just last week, but other presidents who have had to face a number of racially divisive and complicated issues. This is our country, I guess, right? This is our heritage.
It is. It is. And this is the one great issue that has overshadowed so much of American history, and that is first slavery. And since the abolition of slavery, the fallout from that slavery, the people who were freed from bondage but were not allowed to be full citizens in so much of the United States. And wars of varying levels have been fought over this issue, the Civil War itself, sure, of course, but then many, many smaller struggles, in many cases deadly and vicious struggles in many of the states over the citizenship of the descendants of former slaves, and giving people the vote, giving people their civil rights, have been the main domestic struggles we've been through as a nation even since the Civil War.
Well, I'm looking at what you wrote about Harry Truman, who did integrate the military. As you say, this was a Southerner born in rural Missouri. How did he fare?
He, in 1948, was so shocked at the treatment of some of the African-American soldiers who came back from World War II. They returned to their homes, which in those days were still primarily in the South, and many of them were very badly abused and then denied the right to vote and found it extremely difficult to return to society. And Harry Truman was truly shocked by this and sickened by it. And it influenced his decision to go further than Franklin Roosevelt had gone in terms of ordering non-discrimination in the federal government and explicitly outlaw any form of discrimination in the armed services, which had been highly segregated, even into World War I and World War II. And as a result, the armed services were integrated. It took years to effectuate it. Didn't really get completed until Dwight Eisenhower was president. But Harry Truman set it in motion, and he did it in the summer he was running for re-election as president in 1948. It blew up the Democratic Convention. A lot of the Southern states took off and started their own party, States' Rights Party. They nominated their own presidential candidate. People thought that was the end of Harry Truman's political career, but in November, he won.
A Profile in Courage?
You could say.
You quote him, and I just want to read this for, this is President Harry Truman. He says, my forebears were Confederates, but my very stomach turned over when I learned that Negro soldiers just back from overseas were being dumped out of army trucks in Mississippi and beaten. Ron, you quoted him, but I just wanted our listeners to hear those very powerful words.
Yes, you know, and Dwight Eisenhower, who was a general and who had spent most of his life in uniform in the Army, was not a big fan of the Brown versus Board education, Board of Education school integration case in 1954, even though it was product largely of a chief justice he had appointed. He was disturbed by it. He thought it was going to be too sudden and that there would be a lot of pushback in the South, and indeed, of course, there was. But when the push came to shove and nine teenagers tried to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957, Dwight Eisenhower stood by them. He stepped into the situation, sent the 101st Airborne Division, which was one of the most heroic units of World War II, into Little Rock, literally to escort those nine teenagers into Central High School. It is one of the most stirring episodes in the entire civil rights movement history. And Dwight Eisenhower did the right thing, even though many people thought he had not been particularly thrilled with being cast in that role. He played the role of hero in that moment.
But it is interesting how these events that cannot be necessarily predicted then become a test for a president.
Yes, and we saw that again with Kennedy. We saw it again with LBJ. And then a very complicated history of civil rights advocacy at times in the earlier parts of his career for Richard Nixon. But then when he came to running for president for the second time in 1968, he pursued the famous Southern Strategy, which was trying to get the Southern states away from their historic roots voting for the Democratic Party, and succeeded in doing that, as subsequent Republican presidents have done. And much of that has been based on showing a certain amount of sympathy for Southern sentiments about states' rights, about the importance and primacy of certain rights in the South. And that has been a successful transfer, if you will, of the Southern presidential vote, at the very least, between the two parties. So, yeah, unexpected events and unexpected individuals, even when you think about some of the people that Barack Obama had to speak about when he was running for president and as president. Any individual who said something divisive who was African-American, suddenly Barack Obama had to defend them and be their champion. So it is the kind of issue that will spring up, that will suddenly take over, that will take all the oxygen out of the room. I don't think very many people expected the Charlottesville rally to turn into what it's been, but that's just another example of how our history has been all the way back to the beginning.
Maybe an unfair question here, but do you think, especially as the summer is over and Congress begins and we get back to the business of trying to have a government and fund a government, that what happened in Charlottesville will be in our rearview mirror?
It should be, unless there are more of these rallies, unless there are more of these efforts. Now, there were some efforts at it last weekend when some of the groups that had rallied in Charlottesville wanted to go out and do the same in some other cities, Boston, Lexington, Kentucky, so forth. All that seems to have fizzled or been essentially throttled by a lot of counter-demonstrators who were there to say, not here, not now, not in our time. And so I do expect some of these groups to rear their head again. I mean, they are on the march. They feel empowered, and they are going to try to get some more attention. But insofar as Charlottesville has taught us anything, it's that times have changed, and even if people feel empowered in a moment like this, they are going to encounter a different America from what they might have in the 1950s or in other eras, and that there are going to be a lot of people willing to confront them.
I'm going to be talking with Mark Zandi in a couple of minutes about these CEOs that left these business advisory councils, but how there was a member who said, well, look, we never actually ever met. How significant do you think those councils were in the fact that so many members of them left last week?
They were symbolic in nature. They were largely photo opportunities for executives to see the president, be pictured with the president, be seen to be influential with the president, and for the president to absorb some of, if you will, their economic power and heat by having them at a table with him at the head of the table or sitting there talking to them. It was a photo opportunity for all those mm-hmm. concerned. How much it really changed policy is probably highly debatable, but it had symbolic value. And so now to have these executives say they can't participate in that anymore has symbolic value in, if you will, a kind of opposite direction. And for them to be utterly disbanded is perhaps just an acknowledgement that they weren't really of that much value in the first mm-hmm. place. And if they weren't going to do the president political symbolic good, why have them?
Steve Bannon apparently referred to Ivanka and Jared as Javanka. How much clout do they have over both their father and father-in-law?
You know, it seems to be quite a bit. There have been times when Donald Trump's tweets have changed in tone quite a bit, particularly with respect to the Affordable Care Act replacement that was passed by the House of Representatives. At first, the president had a big celebration for it on the grounds of the White House. And then after conversations with Ivanka, he starts calling it mean, M-E-A-N.
Right.
A really different characterization, which hurt the bill. Which hurt the bill and its prospects in the Senate because senators said, hey, I'm going to turn around. I'm going to vote for this thing. The president's going to turn around and call me mean. That was an example of their influence at work. And it is quite pervasive. And those people are never going to be kept away from the president. No matter what else John Kelly may try to do, he is not going to try to separate Donald Trump from his family or his daughter's counsel in particular.
Well, I mean, everyone has to go through Kelly, right, to get to the president as it stands now?
That is how it stands now. I would assume that there might be at least situational exceptions for that, particularly with respect to Ivanka and Jared.
Ron Elving, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
My pleasure as well. I enjoyed it as well. Learned a lot as well. Senior editor, national correspondent for NPR's Washington Desk. And yes, Mark Zandi, waiting in the wings, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, will be talking about the Trump bump on Wall Street and other economic and financial issues. So do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoena, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There were cheers at the New York Stock Exchange on Friday when traders learned that Steve Bannon, President Trump's chief strategist, was out. That capped a week when leading CEOs exited the president's business councils that Trump then disbanded. We asked Mark Zandi to join us, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. We want to talk about what was the message coming from the traders at the stock exchange on Friday. Also, the Trump bump in the last 6 months on Wall Street, and also the state of the U.S. economy. And Mark Zandi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Mark, why did I hear clapping and hurrahs on Wall Street when the news of Bannon was out was official?
Well, I think folks think that Bannon is extreme in his views and counterproductive to getting any economic policy agenda through Congress, particularly tax reform. So his leaving, I think, was something investors were happy about. It means that, or at least in the minds of investors, the probability of getting tax cuts are now higher.
Why, though, is the stock market so bullish on President Trump? I'm not sure what percentage it is, but we're over the 20,000 mark, Mark Zandi, and the stock market has been working its way up ever since the president was inaugurated.
Well, that's not my read on it.
No?
No, the market is up by, if we take the S&P 500, that's an index benchmark for prices in the market. That's up about 15% since the election. That's precisely the percentage increase in the S&P 500 in the 9 months prior to the election. So the global economy, the economy, corporate earnings, all the things that interest rates, all the things that matter in terms of determining stock prices were already in place prior to the election. And I just view this increase in prices since the election just a continuation of what we were saying before it.
So at what point does a president then own an economy and whatever happens on the stock market?
I think, the first year of a presidency is really the previous president's economy. It reflects that president, the previous president's policies and and work on the economy. So it takes about a year before I think it becomes the new president's economy. This one may become President Trump's a little bit more quickly, depending on what happens in the next few weeks, because so far no economic policy has been accomplished, but that's not something that can continue on for very much longer. Congress, the administration have to come together. They have to pass legislation funding the government by the end of September, or the government shuts down. And perhaps more importantly, they have to raise the Treasury debt limit. We have this arcane law about Treasury debt, and if they don't raise a limit, then markets will have a real problem with that. So this may become Trump's economy pretty quickly if they can't figure out how to get a piece of legislation through.
So even though the Affordable Care Act was not repealed or replaced, it's really looking at the debt ceiling. That's what the stock market is looking at?
Well, the market, no, it's not. Yeah, the market's not really focused on that yet because they've seen this script before, and they think, investors think, and I think appropriately so, that you know, at the end of the day, this administration and Congress will get it together. So I don't think that's what's driving things, at least not yet. I think what really will matter for the stock market one way or the other, positive or negative, is if, in fact, tax reform, and more specifically, if corporations get lower tax rates. If that gets through Congress, that would be a big plus for the stock market. That it would cause the market to rise.
Interestingly, Steve Bannon wanted to increase taxes on wealthy people in this country.
Yeah, well, he wanted to do a lot of things, right? So you have to take all the things
did.
In combination. I don't know. You can pick off whatever you want. But in combination, I think investors were pretty pretty happy to see him go.
But are we not we're not talking about irrational exuberance? Again, I mean, you just look at the numbers of the stock market. That seems in line from your perspective, Mark?
No, that's a great point. I think the market has gotten ahead of itself. So independent of Trump, right? You know, lots of other things are going on in the world, and I do think investors have driven up stock prices to levels that are not sustainable long run. You know, the economy is good. Our corporate earnings are strong. Interest rates are low. You know, some of the major threats to the stock market that were around a year or two or three ago are no longer there. You know, China, oil prices, European debt crisis. So there are good reasons for the market to be high. There's even good reasons for it to be at record highs, but this is that and then some. So I think this market is overvalued and is vulnerable to anything that could go wrong, like a shutting down of the government or a breach of the Treasury debt limit. I think that would be pretty hard for the markets to digest. So I think the markets are overvalued.
But why then the pessimism? I mean, if things look good on paper, why do so many people feel that the economy is not helping them?
Well, I'm not so sure that's the case. I mean, if you look at surveys of consumers, there's a couple that are been around for a long time, a survey done by the University of Michigan, another by the Conference Board. They're pretty close to record highs. I mean, it was higher back in the tech bubble boom around Y2K, but other than that, you know, confidence as high as it's been. I think there's big differences in people's feelings. I mean, if you live in urban centers along the coast, big urban centers in the middle of the country, you're probably doing pretty well now. Unemployment's very low, inflation is low, interest rates are low, stock market is high, house prices are back to record highs. So you're feeling pretty good. But if you live in more rural areas, ex-urban areas, opioid crisis, you know, there's lost jobs and the old line, the energy industry, parts of manufacturing, then you're not feeling so good. So there's really, two different worlds out there, and I think that's reflected in some of the angst.
Do you see anything that the president or Congress, either Republicans or Democrats, are doing or can do to address the more rural, middle America?
Well, yeah. Infrastructure would be a big deal, I think.
It would.
It's very difficult to get the folks that are in West Virginia or Kentucky or rural Illinois to come to the urban centers. It just, you know, their homes aren't worth as much. House prices and rents are very high. It's very difficult to move, particularly if you don't have the skills. So given that, then the next best choice is to take the jobs to them. So if we build out infrastructure, build roads, road systems. I mean, think about Pennsylvania for a second, Marty. Here we are.
All the time.
Yeah, I mean, how hard is it to get to Penn State? I mean, come on, really? All we need to do is build a road through the state, rail, better airports, better internet service, broadband service. And I think the jobs will come to those areas because, you know, those are hardworking people that want to work. And the costs are low. Businesses like low cost structures. And so, you know, if we got a big infrastructure bill, and the irony of that is that there's a lot of bipartisan support for it. If we got it, I think that would make, now it doesn't solve the problem overnight, right? I mean, it takes time.
Sure.
We got into this mess over a long period of time. It's going to take us a while to get out, but that would be one solution to this problem.
And that's Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. We call him up from time to time to get his assessment on our economy and also on our financial system. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Mark, I'm curious what you make about the fact that so many CEOs, and these were very well-known CEOs of very successful companies, not just left these business councils, but left very critical of the president. What do you make of that?
Well, they're upset, as they should be. I mean, they got into these councils on the request of the president. And, you know, if you're a CEO and the president says, can you help me out? You say, yeah, you know, I'm there. I'm going to help you as best I can. And so they, I think, went in with the best intentions. You know, frankly, these councils probably weren't ever going to be very substantive anyway in terms of what they got done. It's more symbolic than substantive. But that's okay. You know, symbolism matters, matters a lot. And it showed that they were engaged and willing to help, and that's a good thing. But, you know, the administration has careened from one crisis to the next, and it just became bad for business. I mean, really bad for business to be involved in the administration, particularly when it looked like it was careening out of control. So I think they decided this, you know, enough is enough, and they left. I think the administration takes the blame for it.
Bad for business in that bad for your reputation as a company to be associated?
Yeah, absolutely, right? I mean, think about why they left. It was Charlottesville and the way that was handled. I mean, do you want to be involved with an administration that handles it that way? No. I mean, so, and they were getting a lot of pressure from all of their constituencies, right? Their employees, their boards of directors, and probably most importantly, their customers saying, what in the heck's going on here? So, you know, I think it's just really bad for business. It wasn't helpful to their cause, and they realized they weren't helping. They weren't having really any input into what President Trump has in mind. That the input wasn't there. So, you know, why am I here? And decided to leave.
Kenneth Langone, who's the co-founder of Home Depot, a billionaire, I'm looking here at the New York Times, a prominent Republican fundraiser, vocal supporter of President Trump, and he said, I had high hopes. The president has blown a great opportunity. He completely mishandled the situation in Charlottesville. There was no gray area here. These people were repulsive. He was talking about the white supremacists there. And interestingly, when Ken Frazier, who was born here in the Philadelphia area, when he left the council, President Trump tweeted, now that Ken Frazier of Merck Pharma has resigned from President's Manufacturing Council, he will have more time to lower rip-off drug prices. I wonder whether that tweet also sent a message to some of these members, which is, when you leave, the president's going to kick you in the butt.
Yeah, and I said, let's go. Maybe if we all leave at the same time, he can't do that, right? That's exactly what happened. They said, we're out of here. And, you know, the president said, okay, you know, I can't salvage this. But, let me say this.
Go ahead.
This isn't totally bleak in the sense that there's actually a lot of support, bipartisan support, for a lot of things that want to get done here. I mean, I think everyone would agree that the tax code needs a real overhaul. And that the things can be done to make it much better, more efficient, generate revenue, and help this economy out. So it's just, you know, intellectually we're there. We just have to get there politically. And I think if the president and the administration can get it together and not do these kinds of things, that there's a real chance that they can get tax reform through, and that would be for the good of the American economy long run. Infrastructure spending I mentioned earlier as well, right. A lot of bipartisan support for that. So it's not about, you know, the intellectual consensus, it's about the political consensus. And so if we can get the politics just roughly right, I think the economics can work and we can get something done. So it's not, you know, game's not over here. I mean, we can still get stuff done. You know, of course, it relies on the administration getting itself together.
Let me get Steve from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out that the Senate and Obama had agreed on a jobs bill / infrastructure, and the House Republicans, the same ones that are going to rah-rah for it now, voted it down.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, no, that speaks, I think, Mark, to our political environment perhaps more than anything else.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Same on tax reform, by the way. There was President Obama had put forward a corporate tax plan, which, if we do get a tax reform with this administration, it probably would look pretty close to what Obama put forward back a few years ago. So, yeah, that's the politics of it. But, that's okay. Still better to get it done if we can. I don't think we want to go down the path of, well, you didn't let me get anything done, so I'm not going to let you get anything done. That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, we've been there, haven't we?
Yeah, it just doesn't. Come on, let's just move forward. So, hopefully, the Democrats can see their way clear to support the things that they really want to support, infrastructure spending, tax reform that is revenue neutral. They don't want to give tax cuts that can't be paid for, and they want to make sure that the tax cuts, the benefits of that are evenly distributed. They don't want the benefits to accrue to one group or another, which I think is reasonable. But I think those things can get done, and hopefully the Democrats will engage if the administration is able to get it to that point where the negotiations begin.
Almost out of time here, but what would be, from your perspective, a fair tax reform that would both help the economy but also not advantage one group over another?
Well, it's a tough one, actually, because there's no obvious way to raise the revenue necessary to pay for the lower tax rates. I mean, that was the idea behind the border adjustment tax, complicated thing, but that's died politically, and so that was where a lot of the revenue was going to come from, the lower rates. So it's not clear, but, I think if I were them, I would focus more on the corporate tax side than the personal side, because the personal side is very complicated, lots of economic, political cross currents, very difficult to get that done. So let's go get a win and fix the corporate tax code. We've got this really bizarre Byzantine tax code for multinationals that's causing these multinationals to work really hard to get jobs and their businesses overseas to avoid taxes. That's just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So let's fix that. And if we get the win there, then maybe that drives the momentum to do something bigger and broader. And if you did it, you could do it in a way that wouldn't cost too much, because these multinationals have a lot of cash sitting overseas. And if you reform the code, they'll bring that cash back, you'll tax it, and you'll generate revenue, and that'll help pay for the lower rate. So let's go for a win, I think. That would be my advice. It's not ideal. It'd be great if we could focus on the personal tax code as well. And there will have to be some tweaks there to make it consistent with the corporate tax code. But I think the more logical thing here to do is to try to get a win.
Mark Zandi, always appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
You're very welcome. Chief Economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. And we began our conversation with Ron Elving from NPR, talking about the last couple of days in politics here in America. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.